Beijing's attempt at foreign policy have only served to drive a wedge between the people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait.
Taiwan loses another ally to China in a diplomatic allegiance grab. It's Wednesday, May 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Philippines addresses overseas worker issues. Speaking out in Pakistan and India. A raw materials choice and scarcity. A new malaria treatment and rapid Chinese technology growth. It's all on today's VOA Asia. After nearly 80 years, the Caribbean country of the Dominican Republic has cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan and established relations with mainland China. Fewer than 20 countries now recognize Taiwan, whose Foreign Minister Joseph Wu lashed out at Beijing's tactics.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs strongly condemns China's objectionable decision to use dollar diplomacy to convert Taiwan's diplomatic allies. Beijing's attempt at foreign policy have only served to drive a wedge between the people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, erode mutual trust, and further harm the feelings of the Taiwan people.
Dominican Republic Foreign Minister Miguel Vargas said in Beijing Tuesday his government recognizes the principle of one China, calling Taiwan an inalienable part of China. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi described the new relationship as mutually beneficial. Bill Sharp hosts the online program Asia in Review and is a former visiting scholar at the Institute on Taiwan History. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty he does not see this as a major blow to Taiwan.
When it comes right down to it, Taiwan's international relations with the United States, Japan, the EU, Canada, and Australia are the most important. These are all countries with which Taiwan has no official diplomatic relations. More than that, Taiwan's economic relations with countries around the world is important. And Taiwan maintains a robust economic relations with a huge number of countries around the world. The one advantage is with its handful of allies, it has sometimes been able to get motions introduced at the United Nations or the World Health Organization that seek to help Taiwan, but for the most part, they've been unsuccessful anyway.
Has China's dollar diplomacy really paid off?
I think there's some different ways to look at it. Now, if one looks at Africa, where China has made large investments to African countries and other countries around the world, usually poor, underdeveloped countries, just like the Dominican Republic, the loans are supposed to be tied to building infrastructure, which is to be built by Chinese companies with Chinese workers. And then it seems that shortly down the road, these countries realize they're unable to repay this money. So then what China does is it takes over that infrastructure that was supposed to ultimately be the property of the recipient country. There's so many examples of this in Africa. Sri Lanka is an example. When one looks at the Dominican Republic, it's very interesting to see the strategic location of the Dominican Republic, right there in the middle of the Caribbean. And this has to be a strategic importance to the United States. A few months ago, we had an enormous storm in the Caribbean that wreaked great havoc on all countries and colonies in that area, created great, great damage, including the United States, Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. I knew at that time that this was going to create great opportunities for China because of the amount of money needed to rebuild those poor countries. And I suspect that this might be factoring in on the Dominican Republic's decision to go with China.
Bill Sharp said with its geostrategic location near the United States, like Cuba, the Dominican Republic could someday become another listening post for China. Given what he called Taiwan's high-quality foreign aid, he questioned whether countries like the Dominican Republic will receive the same care and attention from mainland China. And Sharp said flipping one-time allies of Taiwan can only harden the resolve of the Taiwanese people to keep the status quo and not become a part of China. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. South Korea wants United Nations help to monitor closing of North's nuclear facility. India's Supreme Court orders speedier investigations of child rape cases. Australian cardinal to go on trial for sexual abuse charges. Japan's Abe seeks support for constitutional revision. Pakistan reopens major trade route with Afghanistan. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A diplomatic row between Kuwait and the Philippines over the protection of the rights of tens of thousands of Filipinos working in the Gulf state appears to have eased just after President Rodrigo Duterte announced a permanent ban on his countrymen from going to the sheikdom. Last week, Kuwait expelled the Philippine ambassador and recalled its envoy from Manila. Reports of abuse have been circulating for months, and the dispute reached a new height when the Philippine embassy staff tried to rescue domestic workers. In February, Mr. Duterte called on the move of more than 260,000 Filipinos in Kuwait to return home after the discovery of a Filipina maid's body in a freezer. Stephen Rood is a fellow in residence at the Manila-based social weather stations. He tells VOA the situation appears to be stabilizing, but the Filipinos need protection and good formal diplomatic relations to accomplish that.
Secondly, the Philippine government may have learned a lesson about how not to project its sort of rough-and-ready image abroad in a way that causes other nations to react. There are persistent reports of some abuses, 260,000 people, some 6,000 complained of abuses in the last couple of years. But most recently, the incident that sparked the current row was that during negotiations for better protection, the Philippine embassy launched unauthorized rescue missions and then filmed those rescue missions and the Department of Foreign Affairs in order to project its image, put that out on the web, and it really offended the Kuwaiti government to have people doing that kind of thing inside their sovereign territory. The people who actually did it need to be investigated in terms of what they did to violate the laws of Kuwait. Several thousand have come home, but the vast majority want to stay there. 100,000 of them are various kinds of technical workers, and 150,000 of them are domestic workers. So they're willing to put up with restrictions and run the risk of abuses in order to have better-paying jobs.
Stephen Rood notes overseas workers contribute a significant income back to their home.
Overall, very important macroeconomic boost. Some 10% of the gross domestic product comes from overseas Philippine remittances, one of the largest proportions in the world.
Rood says President Duterte's declaration of a ban on overseas workers caught many by surprise.
Yes, it was very interesting. On his return from an ASEAN meeting, he had one of his late-night press conferences where he announced that the ban was permanent. And the next day, both his Secretary of Labor and his spokesman said that permanent didn't really mean permanent, but permanent until a better agreement was reached. So they quickly clarified his comments in order to provide room for negotiation.
Stephen Rood said one of the informal practices causing problems is for a Kuwaiti employer to confiscate the passport of a Filipino worker, thereby ensuring that worker goes nowhere else. He also expects agreement to be reached on allowing Philippine diplomats to better deal with the grievances of Filipinos in Kuwait. Happening now in Asia, South Korean President Moon Jae-in wants the United Nations to help monitor North Korea's closing of its Punggye-ri nuclear test facility. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to close the test site by the end of May and reportedly plans to invite experts and journalists from Seoul and the United States to observe. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. India's Supreme Court on Tuesday ordered high courts to ensure speedier investigations of child rape cases amid outrage over recent rapes and killings of young girls and other attacks on children. The bench, headed by Chief Justice Deepak Misra, also ordered the creation of task forces to investigate the fast-track cases and that they be decided by special courts. As the political fallout heightened over the surge in rapes and killings of children,
The Indian government approved the death penalty last month for those convicted of raping children under the age of 12. The move was seen as an effort to signal the government's commitment to fight crimes against young girls and infants as it faces mounting criticism for not doing enough to tackle what some call India's epidemic of sexual violence. Indian cities have recently seen street protests by agonized citizens after details emerged about the gang rape in January in Kashmir of an 8-year-old Muslim girl who was kidnapped, drugged, and raped for days and then murdered. Anger grew because Hindu activists had demonstrated in support of the 8 arrested men. Separately, one of India's most charismatic and controversial spiritual gurus with millions of followers was sentenced to life in prison last month for raping a teenage girl. The trial was the most recent in a string of high-profile rape cases in India that have sparked public protests and raised questions about how law enforcers handle rapes and treat victims. Meanwhile, in neighboring Pakistan, members of the Hazara community, a minority Shiite sect, are on a hunger strike for a third day against targeted killings their community has faced for years. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
Pakistan's Hazaras have been victims of targeted killings for almost 2 decades. The murders have recently spiked, with 4 separate attacks in April. Members of the community are on a hunger strike to try to get attention to their plight.
I want to request Army Chief Bajwa to come here as a common man, as a father, as a husband, and feel our pain. We have 3,000 widows and 10,000 orphans. Face them. Tell them why their loved ones are being killed.
During the weekend, Provincial Home Minister Mir Sarfaraz Bukti visited the hunger strikers. He assured the protesters the provincial government is taking steps to arrest elements involved in target killings. But the protesters rejected his request to end the strike and voiced dissatisfaction with the government's performance.
Who are these people who come and shoot our youth despite the presence of security checkposts? We want to find out who they are.
Thousands of Hazaras have been killed in bomb blasts or shootings during the past 2 decades. Sunni militant groups have taken responsibility for most of these attacks. In most cases, the attackers have managed to escape. In Pakistan, Shiites are a regular target of Sunni militant groups. Hazaras appear to bear the brunt of that violence since their distinctive facial features, a mixture of Mongolian and Central Asian ancestry, make them easily identifiable. In addition, many of them live in 2 large clusters in Quetta and have limited routes out of their communities, making attacks easier to plan. Pakistan's National Commission of Human Rights said in a recent report that more than 700 Hazaras were killed in various incidents of terrorism in Quetta in the past 5 years. The government says it is doing all it can to protect the community. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
You can see video of this story and many more online at VOA Asia's Facebook page and also on the voanews.com website. Coming up, the business of materials availability. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, a twin suicide bombing in Afghanistan's capital Kabul on Monday killed at least 26 people, including 9 journalists. At least 50 other people were wounded, including 5 journalists. Islamic State claimed responsibility for the deadliest ever assault on media workers in Afghanistan. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more on this and many more stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, growing illicit raw materials in Afghanistan and a shortage of legitimate materials in India are the topics of this week's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Recent Afghan government data shows that production of poppies in Afghanistan increased by 87% between 2016 and 2017, setting a record high. Despite international pressure and government incentives to grow other crops, farmers still find poppies to be the most lucrative. Mohammed Nadir is a local farmer.
The opium money is good enough to cover life expenses, such as our wedding party expenses. The wedding party cost is very high, such as 1 or 2 million Pakistani rupees. That is why most farmers cultivate poppy in order to cover life expenses.
Mohammed Nadir makes $3,000 a year from his poppies in a country where the per capita GDP is less than $600. The Taliban take a cut of these profits, offering protection for his fields and a connection to international and domestic smugglers in exchange. If Nadir were to switch to a different crop, like wheat, his income would fall by about a third. Last year, the government distributed more than 10,000 tons of wheat seeds to farmers, along with 20,000 tons of fertilizer, in an effort to incentivize change, but their efforts failed. Many blame the lack of infrastructure and inability to process and transport produce out of landlocked Afghanistan. Mohammed Nadir.
The government asked us not to cultivate poppies, but we ignore the government and continue to cultivate. The Taliban never say anything to us, and they are happy with us because they gather money from the farmers for the opium.
As poppy production has spread north to areas not traditionally associated with the plant, areas under poppy cultivation have jumped by 63%. Current government and UN statistics show that this opium brings in about $1.39 billion per year, which is roughly equivalent to 7% of Afghanistan's GDP. The cost of raw materials in India has risen, creating a crisis in the foundry industry, which caters to the automobile, railway, defense, and electrical industries. The price of iron scrap has gone up by as much as 15%, crystalline petroleum by 30%, and pig iron is as high as it has been in a decade. The price hike stems from tightened environmental laws in China. Amish Panchal is the president at the Institute of Indian Foundrymen.
Majority of carbon chemicals and ferroalloys plants in China were shut down for almost 3 months. They were forced to put pollution control equipment. Due to that, there was a severe shortage of these raw materials in China. So Indian foundry industry in turn was also very badly affected.
The foundry industry in India is still trying to recover from the effects of demonetization and the goods and services tax, which came into effect in July. Many analysts expect steel companies to pass on the increased costs of production to their consumers. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, analysts are cautioning that New Delhi will have to wait to see whether the display of goodwill between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi actually results in lower border tensions. The two met after a dangerous military standoff in the Himalayan mountains, which raised fears of a wider conflict. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. Stay informed while enjoying the lighter side of the news. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists in Kenya believe they have discovered a new way to combat malaria. As Faith Lapidus reports, a common medication already used to treat a host of illnesses makes people's blood poisonous to the mosquito, which spreads the deadly disease.
Malaria remains one of the world's most stubborn health challenges, infecting more than 200 million people every year and killing about 500,000, most of them children in Africa. The disease spreads when a mosquito bites someone already infected, sucks up blood and parasites, and then bites another person. Scientists working with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and the Kenya Medical Research Institute believe they may have found a new way to prevent the spread of malaria in small communities. It's a drug called ivermectin.
For a long time, it's been used as a prescription medicine for treatment of intestinal worms, mostly in children and even in adults. And in parts of West Africa, it's actually been used for control of river blindness disease, what we call onchocerciasis. So what we found out was that the moment somebody takes ivermectin, if a mosquito bites them, they actually become poisonous to that mosquito.
To be effective, researchers say the medicine needs to be distributed in a controlled and calculated way throughout a community.
So ideally, ivermectin would be given in what's called a mass drug administration. So if we select a community, a village, for example, or a county, for example, everybody in that county receives the drug at the same time. So it means that for that period of time, for the 28 days that ivermectin is effective, you'd have a continuous killing effect. So everybody that a mosquito comes and bites at that time would actually die.
That would be good news for the millions of people infected with malaria every year. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
If you want your technology sector to expand rapidly, it pays to have strong support from your government, easy access to bank loans, and a large market hungry for your products. All this is available in China, where technology companies are expanding at a rapid pace. VOA's George Pudich tells us that expansion is making other countries, including the United States, a bit uneasy.
Of the thousands of exhibitors at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, the largest in the world, nearly 500 came from the major Chinese metropolis of Shenzhen. One of the biggest exhibits belonged to the communications giant Huawei, also based in Shenzhen, where officials are not shy about their ambitions.
Nobody believes, I think it's in China, it's, let's say, a Chinese company can do business, you know, worldwide and can be a leader in technology. I think if you don't visit us, I think you don't believe these things. But we did it.
For many Chinese companies, the key phrase is artificial intelligence, or AI, which promises to drive everything from smartphones to autonomous cars and robotic machinery in factories.
We can tell that all the large technical companies attach great importance to AI research. We can even say that some companies have made AI a top priority in their strategy, because it is likely that AI will be a fundamental tool to significantly advancing efficiency across all industries in the future.
Another important factor is the speed at which the data can flow between all those devices. Chinese companies are spending a lot of money developing 5G, the soon-to-be-deployed fifth generation of wireless technology that will be able to transfer up to 10 times more data per second than the current 4G technology.
5G technology is largely going to be about making sure that all of our mobile devices get data faster, can get more data, and in that capacity are going to be able to process a lot more of these kinds of AI computations and do so with much less load on our infrastructure and our capacity for wireless networks.
In other words, by using 5G, devices with artificial intelligence, from smartphones to cars to robots, will become part of the so-called Internet of Things, a giant internet-based network that can control connected devices around the world, anytime and anywhere. All this is making U.S. high-tech companies a little uneasy. While they have to follow strict U.S. laws concerning safety and data privacy, Chinese companies enjoy much less stringent standards, including those related to intellectual property rights.
That sense that China is cultivating national champions and cultivating companies within its own borders at the expense of other companies has a lot of U.S. companies concerned about how much their intellectual property rights will be safeguarded there.
While analysts say current U.S. technology is still superior, trends suggest Chinese know-how is not just catching up, but could someday surpass the rest of the world. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can hear us across many parts of Asia, including at DZUP 1602 on your AM radio dial, broadcasting from the University of the Philippines, Diliman. So if you happen to be in Quezon City, check out DZUP and our program. We thank everyone there who is listening, and we also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a very nice day ahead.